This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, my guest is Danielle Alesi. She is assistant professor at Millikan College, and she wrote a great essay in a book titled Game of Thrones versus History, Written Blood. Brian Pavlak edits the book, and Dr. Alesi writes a chapter in that book on Sansa. So she's going to help me cover this crucial chapter in Sansa's story. You can follow her on Twitter at Danielle_Alesi. Find out more about what she's interested in. Then Steve and I talk about Home. What an amazing episode. Okay, without further ado, here is Dr. Danielle Alesi. Danielle, would you tell me a little bit about Elizabeth of York? Because the reason why I came across your name, You wrote an essay in Brian Pavlak's edited volume, Game of Thrones versus History, Written in Blood. That's Wiley Blackwell, if you would like to look at their website. And honestly, a great price for a Wiley Blackwell book. Because Wiley Blackwell is sort of known for overpricing their book. In my experience, that is the case. But this book is very well priced. And you wrote an essay on Sansa, and I was hoping that you could maybe tell us about a couple parallels between Sansa and Elizabeth.
Yeah. So, you know, Sansa actually has a lot of parallels with a lot of medieval women, and I think that's what's so striking about her. And Elizabeth of York is just one that stands out a lot because of the overall parallels between Game of Thrones and the Wars of the Roses, the English Civil War in the late Middle Ages that the Game of Thrones was potentially inspired by or has a lot of similar parallels.
Oh, absolutely inspired by.
Yeah. Right. And I'm sure you maybe mentioned that or talked about that before here on the podcast. But so Elizabeth of York is there's definitely some even similarities between the names there, York and Stark, Lannister versus Lancaster. These are the families that are embroiled in this civil war. And Elizabeth is one of the daughters, the eldest daughter, in fact, of King Edward IV of England, who's one of the main kings kind of wrapped up in this dynastic war.
Right.
Her mother is Elizabeth Woodville, who's notably one of our few commoner queens. Right? She was raised to the position of queen consort with Edward. She's not like a foreign princess, which was more common for the time.
Sure.
But then Elizabeth of York, so she's named after her mother. There's lots of Elizabeths, lots of Edwards in these stories. She is an important princess. She's the Princess of Wales. She's the firstborn daughter. Later sons come along to become important there. She's got a lot of siblings, just like Sansa has. But the real similarities between them, I think, are one that Elizabeth of York was also used as a dynastic political pawn. Kind of the women in this time, especially women born in the aristocratic or the royal class, their bodies were these conduits of power. Through marriage, through childbearing, they're able to pass along power, inheritance, titles, names. And so that's something that we see happen a lot with Elizabeth of York's story. Beyond that, she spent time as a political captive throughout the war, being passed from kind of side to side, depending on who is in power. We see that happen a lot with Sansa. We also see, you know, at the end of the Wars of the Roses, it's really the marriage to Elizabeth bringing her name, bringing her claim after her brothers are, for all we know, killed. It's the marriage of her that really ends the war, brings peace because of that ability of her to bring her inheritance, her name, her power, and say, well, now this is the alliance, right? So her marriage is an alliance in every sense of the word. And we see that happen a lot with Sansa, right? In both the book and the show.
Yeah. Do you get the sense that Elizabeth knew that she was a political asset? Like is her, you know, people want something from her, right? They want something from her body, or they want some sort of treaty based on marriage or something like that. That was her value to these power brokers. Do you think that she knows that she has value in that way?
Yes. Right. Yes. I think that Elizabeth and women like Elizabeth, girls like Elizabeth when they're children, are very, very well-versed in their role in society and their importance in the family, especially an eldest royal daughter like Elizabeth. It would have been foundational to her education. No matter, take the wars and the Civil War out of the conversation, she would have always known that she was going to marry for an alliance. Mm-hmm. She was betrothed at a very young age to a series of people in the effort to kind of create these alliances.
Right.
That would have been something she was aware of. She would have known that that was her future, similar to how Sansa does. And yeah, she would have known that.
Yeah, good. I'm glad that you said that. Maybe this is like a little point of conversation here, because I don't get the sense in these early Sansa chapters... And it could be Martin is sort of creating an anachronism here, but I don't get the sense with Sansa that she really knows why she might be valuable to Cersei or why she might be valuable to Littlefinger. It feels like she feels like she loves Joffrey. She was promised to Joffrey, and that's the reason why she needs to be wed to Joffrey. I don't really get the sense that Sansa has a strong awareness that she is a political asset and that they're treating her like a political asset. I feel like I don't know if Sansa quite, I mean, she's savvy in a lot of ways, but I don't know if she's savvy in that way.
You know, that's really interesting you say that. And I know that it's a little bit different for me because I've spent a lot of time with Sansa. Spent a lot of time in her chapters and thinking about her.
And we're pretty early on in her story here still.
Yeah. And I read it differently.
Oh, good.
I think that maybe she doesn't have the... She's a child in these chapters, and she doesn't have the language at her fingertips to call it what it is. But if you actually do a close reading and read between the lines of what she's saying, the sentiment is there for me. I'm looking at this chapter, and not to get ahead of ourselves or anything, but she says these things. She has this awareness that she could have a role, she could have power. And when she says this a lot in this chapter, when she marries Joffrey, she could convince him to do X, Y, and Z.
Sure.
She could stop them. And it's right at the end of the chapter, and she says, you know, if her mother or if Rob, if they do something wrong, they could ruin everything, but she can do it. She's got it.
Right.
And so I think she is seeing that she has significance and that she is important, and that she could maneuver things, even if she doesn't at this point have the language to call it what it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. And she does say from time to time, I think she tries to use her engagement to Joffrey sort of as leverage. Like she'll say, look, get word to Joffrey, right? When we get older, we're going to marry.
Exactly. I wrote down the same line.
She's trying to use it, but I almost feel like she thinks that one day she will have power. I don't think that she knows that she is a political asset right now. So I don't know. I think that Cersei sees her and thinks, I need to use this thing in front of me because this thing in front of me is going to give me leverage over the Northern armies.
Yeah.
And well, Sansa feels like, I don't think she knows that Cersei views her that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, I think that maybe Sansa would have, Sansa and Elizabeth, for example, would have similar understanding of what power meant at this time. Mm. You know, they would know that they were going to make an advantageous marriage for their family, that was they were going to maybe symbolize an alliance. They would have that awareness. And I think she does at this point. She would know that when she's training, right? It's different than Arya's training, but she's training nonetheless. She's learning, right. She says in here, her letters and her sums. She's learning needlepoint. She's watching her mother do certain things, run a household. She would know that that's for a reason, that mm-hmm. she's going to have a role to play one day. Does she or Elizabeth necessarily know that there's going to be wars or armies or the need to mm-hmm. convince the king to pardon someone? No, maybe not. And I think what's so special about this chapter that we're discussing is that for me, this represents a big turning point for Sansa in her experience, where she's shifting into this role of more of a political actor, whether she knows it or not.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. This is, this is kind of forced upon her. I don't think that this would be her natural inclination to think like, well, I got to get something over on Littlefinger now in order to get what I want. She's just not there yet.
No, but she's going to learn that. And that's part of her arc.
Well,
right?
She's going to get forced into that really, really quickly here. Let me read my synopsis and then we can talk a little bit more about this.
Sounds great.
Sansa is isolated and locked in a room. Her only company is Jane Poole, who can only cry. Sansa has heard the sounds of violence, but she has no idea what has taken place. Although she guesses that the king has died, her pleas to be in contact with Cersei or Joffrey are not heeded. Finally, after 3 days, she is escorted to a council of Cersei, Baelish, Varys, and Pycelle. When Sansa hears that her father has been accused of treason, she protests. But the adults threaten to sever her engagement with Joffrey unless she helps them. Cersei needs her to write a letter to her brothers, mother, aunt, and grandfather in order to keep the king's peace. After a futile attempt to ask for her father, Sansa feels helpless and agrees. Later that night, she realizes that she's forgotten to ask about Arya. So, Danielle, would you like to talk about a character or a theme or a plot point, or shall you and I just climb the ladder of chaos?
No, I feel like we should just climb the ladder, see where it takes
us. Let's climb the ladder. You take the first rung. What do you want to talk about?
I think I just definitely want to talk about, to start off with, this turning point for Sansa in this chapter. That I see this as her crossing a threshold into being a political captive now. There's a lot to unpack there. So I'd like to start there.
Okay, good. All right. So she's certainly a hostage. And you're saying that this is sort of a major shift in her character development.
Yeah. I think a lot of people read that shift to happen when, especially in the show, right, when she sees her father dead, like when she turns against Joffrey. Mm. But that is an important part, a movement for her. But I think the real transition, the first transition in her story, actually happened in this chapter, where we really start to see her making choices. Mm. And for me, when I write about Sansa, when I think about her, it's all about where is her agency? Where is she making choices here? Mm. We may not like her choices. We may not have chosen them ourselves, but she's making choices. She's doing things, even if we don't always recognize that in her.
Right. I mean, I guess in a major way, she chooses to ask after her father, ask after Jane Poole's father. This is not something that she knows she should do because of courtesy, right?
Yeah.
But she almost feels like, I know that I'm not supposed to say this right now, but I have to ask mm-hmm. this question. And then, of course, she eventually chooses not to go down the path when she sees where that is leading, and she makes a choice to be Cersei's mouthpiece, I suppose. Which I guess is a question of, like, is that agency? Because it seems like there's almost like a choice to a shoe agency in that case?
Well, when she makes that choice, she doesn't really frame it as that she's doing it for Cersei or that she's saying what Cersei wants her to say. She's not reading it that way. I think instead it's kind of back to what I was mentioning before. She's seeing this as the first step to her bigger plan, which is to later convince Joffrey to pardon everybody.
I see. Right? I see. No, that's a good point.
It's almost like she sees this council, the queen and company, offering her the first step in her larger plan here, and it's starting to formulate, and we're in her head as it's coming up, as she's coming up with this larger plan. And it's frankly a plan that would have been really common for medieval women in her position. The role of the mediator and the intercessor was one that queen consorts would expect to play at one point or another. So it's something that, again, I think it affirms that she kind of knows her role, and she knows what her eventual role in society could be, and she's working towards that now.
Right.
Yeah. So I see it as a choice. She's making that choice, and it's part of her grand scheme. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't always think of Sansa as scheming, but I think this is her first scheme one of her first schemes that we start to see.
Right. Sure. And I think that there's something about the fact that she has to decide in the moment. You know, there's something about, okay, now this is not what I wanted. What I wanted to do was talk with my father.
Yeah.
But they're not going to let me do that. And that is going to ruin this plan I have with Joffrey. So what's plan B here? Well, plan B is stay the course, become queen, and then plead for my brothers or my mother or my father, whatever I can do once I actually am sitting next to Joffrey.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, we definitely should note she's being manipulated in this moment. I mean, we can't kind of shy away from that. And there's this part where Pycelle says, you know, it will go hard for them, right, if they don't listen to her. Right. There's a survival aspect too. She's kind of being pushed in a way. It's like she thinks she's protecting her family. Mm.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. She wants to protect her family, and I think that, well, I have a very I have a very complicated relationship with Sansa.
Many do.
I think I have been educated by a few different podcast guests about Sansa. I've been educated to read Sansa in a way differently than I used to read Sansa. Mm-hmm. And the way I used to read Sansa was that, are you good, Sansa bad? Mm-hmm. It was pretty simple.
Yeah.
Arya's loyal and she's brave, and Arya, you know, eschewing traditional gender roles, and Arya, you know, all of these great things about Arya. And of course, Sansa is set against Arya in many ways. I mean, they're just so opposite. And even in this chapter, we learn that Sansa's really good at reading, better than any of her siblings. Mm-hmm. But then in other chapters, we learn that Arya's really good at sums. Mm-hmm. And Sansa's hopeless at sums. So they're just really being set against one another throughout. And I think Martin tricked me. I think I got tricked. Because I used to think that Sansa's sort of this, you know, she's pretty selfish, and she's trying. She really doesn't care about her sister. She doesn't really care about Jane Poole. In reality, she cares about her own social advancement. Mm-hmm. And I still believe that. I still believe that about her. And yet, I know that Sansa is working with the tools she has available to survive. Like everyone else in this story has to work with the tools that they have available to survive. And yet, Danielle, I have to admit, I read this chapter and I think, do you really care about Jane Poole? I'm not sure. Do you really care about Arya? I'm pretty sure you don't, because you completely forgot to ask about your sister until after you were done reading your fantasy stories. So, yeah, I don't, like I said, complicated relationship.
Yeah, I have a few things to say
about that.
I think that's always where we're gonna go when we're talking about Sansa, especially early Sansa, right? Early chapters of her. Mm-hmm. bring up a lot of this stuff, these uneasy feelings. And sometimes I feel like I get put in these positions where I have to defend Sansa at the expense of Arya. And that's just playing the same game,
right?
Just comparing two girls, two sisters yes. against each other.
Don't be tricked by George. Don't be fooled.
But it does, your comments do beg the question of, do we ever look in Arya's chapters for her worrying about Sansa?
That's a good question.
Yeah, but Martin puts it on the page for us to deal with Sansa, so we have to deal with that.
Right. No, that's a really good question. Does Arya ever care about Sansa in her... I mean, certainly when Sansa is creating difficulty for... I mean, Sansa sometimes will put Arya in an impossible situation. Mm-hmm. Or she'll be, you know... deriding her or something like that.
Yeah.
Normally what'll happen with both sisters is that when they think about some problem that would have been easier if their sister hadn't complicated it, mm-hmm. they're not thinking about one another. And they just don't have that kind of relationship.
I think whether George did this purposely or accidentally, because it's in our subconscious, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. What he presents is something very real, which is two sisters that are, whether on the page or outside of the page, pitted against each other. And they are aware of that in the text, that they are the kind of the opposite to one another. Their expectations are different. Sansa is frustrated with Arya because she sees herself as doing what she's supposed to do, and so frustrated that her sister mm-hmm. can't do that. Mm-hmm. And it's all on Sansa to do that, to be the good one, right? To do these things. And then Arya has her own baggage from that. She's never going to be as pretty or perfect as Sansa. She's going to forge her own path, right? And so I think that's just a really relatable, I would take history out of that. It's a really relatable sure. place to be.
Yeah.
These two sisters that are struggling, figuring out their identities in opposition to this counterpart to them. It's the two girls in the family.
Right. I think that there's something about, like, even though this story is set in a world far, far away, right? Both in terms of the genre and in terms of sort of an antiquated fantasy world.
Yeah.
There's something universal about the feeling of a sibling you don't get along with, right? Mm-hmm. Right? So it's like there's something sort of common to the human experience. Because we can all kind of look back, and even if we don't have a sibling, we have some other young person that made our life complicated. Mm-hmm. It's that first little introduction to politics, right? It's like, all right, how do I? Okay, they provoked me, and then I lashed out at them. So who's really at fault? Now how do I spin this to mom? You know, how do I make myself seem like the good guy to dad or something like that? It really is sort of this trial run for the Game of Thrones. So I like that. Yeah. I like that these two sisters have a complicated relationship. And I think I meant to like Arya more at this point. I think that that's maybe what I'm supposed to do. And I don't know if that sort of is an appeal to my masculinity because Arya presents in more masculine ways or something like that. But it certainly is how I approached this book when I first read it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's in the text. I think that's also in our, we're just kind of socially conditioned to see that the type of power and agency and feminism that we see in Arya is celebrated. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that we're supposed to see as like a feminist icon. We want to be like her, play with the boys, be tough, right? And Arya is amazing for all those reasons.
Right.
But then I think we're also so conditioned to see Sansa's version of strength, of survival, of power, of agency as bad, mm-hmm. As not as good, as not powerful. I mean, power is typically coded masculine anyway.
Right.
So Sansa's feminine power is just not read the same way. And she's, I think this chapter, I wanted to say this before too, this chapter makes us uncomfortable. about Sansa. Right. That's what it's doing. It's supposed like you do feel uncomfortable. Yeah. And I get that, right? I'm not going to spend our time going line by line defending all of her actions. We're supposed, especially at the end when she forgets about her sister. That's why it's in there.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be uncomfortable with Sansa. But I think bigger than that, Sansa as a character mm-hmm. always makes us a little bit uncomfortable because we don't know how to read her power, her survival skills. They don't register as impressive or important or admirable as Daenerys or Arya right. or Brienne, right? We see those as the girls you want to look up to. And Sansa's the, you know, it's like the not like other girls trope.
Yeah.
And Sansa's like other girls. But I think what we're starting to learn as a society and iterate as a society is that it's okay to be like other girls too.
Right.
That's also legitimate.
And I think that is sort of a modern, how do I say this? It's sort of modern eyes rethinking through a much earlier sentiment, because I think that in the real life world, you know, before the modern period, you would look at a woman that presents as Arya presents and think, well, this is no good. You know, this is not attractive. This is not anything to be encouraged, right? Mm. But then because we have these modern eyes, it's like, no, this person's brave. Look how brave she is to cast off these feminine shackles, you know, something like mm-hmm. that. And I think that that's probably what I'm guilty of doing. I think that I'm probably guilty of rooting for Arya because of that. And I was even contrasting, I even felt like I was contrasting Arya and Sansa in this chapter, because this chapter comes right after an Arya chapter. And in the Arya chapter before, she's being taught to see, right? Now, what do you actually see? You know, Ciri Forella saying, no, my eyes told you where the sword was going to be. You need to learn to see in a way that will help you survive. And then in this chapter, what's Sansa doing? She can't see anything. She's locked in a room. She can only hear the battle. And then when she gets out on the courtyard, she won't look at the corpse. She looks away because it might be someone that she might know, and she just can't look at it. So I'm even trying to contrast, like, the lesson Arya just learned and this very same lesson that Sansa refuses to learn. But I think that it's unfair. I think that Sansa just sees things that Arya wouldn't. Like, they see the world in a different way.
And we, you know, written on top of Sansa's story in both the book and the show, but in very different ways after this chapter, right? This is my turning point chapter, mm-hmm. she is a survivor. Right, a victim. We prefer to call them survivors. Whether it's an assault, and she's physically assaulted in the books, what happens to her later in the show, you know, these, and even just being a political captive, the taunting she experiences from Joffrey, this is abuse. She is a survivor of abuse.
Yeah.
And so we have to be really careful, especially moving forward in her story, of how we judge how survivors survive.
Hmm.
And how they deal with what's happening around them.
And
I think that that's,
right?
Yeah, she's a child.
Yeah.
And, you know, she, whilst Arya's learning her tools for survival, and they're very recognizable, right?
Mm-hmm.
She picks up a sword, learning how to fight, running, right? Protecting herself, doing these really obvious moments. Sansa's are there. They're just so much more subtle and so much less flashy, right? When she makes this choice in this chapter, when Sir Boris comes to get her, right, and she says that she's going to be she's going to stay graceful, right? She says a lady remembers her courtesies,
right.
And she was resolved to be a lady no matter what. And this starts a moment for her,
right,
that hindsight shows us, because we know her later chapters, that she, no matter what happens, is going to maintain her courtesy.
Well, that's her armor, right?
Yeah,
that is exactly how she's going to survive. I want to read this little passage, because I think it does kind of show that Sansa's eyes are open. She's just looking for different things and seeing things that Arya wouldn't see. So here's what happened. She's in the room with the council, and it says, Sansa seated herself beside the queen. Cersei smiled again. but that did not make her feel any less anxious.
Yeah.
Varys was wringing his soft hands together. Grand Maester Pycelle kept his sleepy eyes on the paper in front of him, but she could see Littlefinger staring. Something about the way the small man looked at her made Sansa feel as though she had no clothes on. Goosebumps pimpled her skin. And so Sansa can notice that Cersei's wearing clothes as if she's in mourning, right? She notices that the clothing means something. She notices how Pycelle is holding his head and his eyes. She notices that Varys smells flowery and he's wringing his hands. And she notices that Littlefinger is looking at her in a way that is inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all things, these are all ways that she has been trained to see the world. She's starting to read politics, in other words.
Yes,
Behind the words, she can read that Cersei's smile is not a smile that should make her feel any less anxious, right? So she's absolutely learning to read people politically. It's just, you're right, it's absolutely more subtle than we would find in the Arya chapters.
Part of this threshold that she's crossing, this turning point she's experiencing into political captive, as you noted, also a political actor too. Mm-hmm. She's starting to use those skills. Is just reiterating that armor that she starts to put on, the courtesy, the using her potential marriage to Joffrey as protection. She does that early on, and kind of realizing subconsciously. Even she says, you know, she wants to wed the king, but that would be protection, that she would be then queen, right? And just reiterating the importance of her using her type of weaponry, hiding behind this courtesy, even though, you know, her first thought is that this knight is ugly, which is, you look so handsome, right? She's acting politically in those moments too. Yeah, it's not Arya's sword, but it's still her version of power, okay. Her type of courage. Sure. And that, again, it would have been something that is much more familiar to most women in history.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that maybe that parlays into the next thing I wanted to ask you about, because this is an important Jane Poole chapter, even though she's sort of this marginal character.
Yeah.
And she's not represented in the show. I guess she is represented in the show just in a different way. Basically, Sansa gets some of her storyline, right?
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about Jane Poole, because is Jane Poole the only one acting appropriately in this chapter? I mean, she comes in and she's bruised and crying. Bruised means she's been assaulted, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So she's been assaulted. She's weeping as if, you know, she's never going to see her father again. Although Sansa, from Sansa's point of view, this is not anything to cry about. Sansa, oh, she's such a child. But I'm thinking, is that the case? I think that maybe Jane Poole's the only one that knows what's really happening around these parts. And acting appropriate based on what she has seen in the courtyard. So I guess that's my question. I think that maybe, is Jane Poole the only one acting appropriately?
Sure, yeah. But, you know, it brings up these larger points I want to get to or talk about with her. I love that Jane's in this chapter, even though it's really ominous knowing what's going to happen to her.
Yeah. Right.
And that moment where she shifted into Littlefinger's custody is chilling, right?
It's horror. I wrote down horror next to what he says, I will find a place for her. And I exclamation point, nothing good is going to happen to her now.
Yeah. But all that, everything you said, from the bruises, all the crying, to what she truly does know in her heart about her father, and then to what happens off page to her, but we know happens when she's passed into Littlefinger's care. It's illustrating this really important class distinction between her and Sansa.
Okay.
That they are friends, they sleep in the bed like sisters, there's this love and companionship between them, but Jane's body is not worth what Sansa's body is worth.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's right there on the page. So having her in this chapter reminds us this, something again that makes us really uncomfortable, right? Something that we have to look at, that the, as much as we want to talk about, you know, the passage of power through Sansa's body, her claim, her title, what marrying her could do. And yes, she does experience assault and things that we can talk about later. But for Jane, I mean, she's never protected from that.
Right.
From the very, very beginning, her body's not worth what Sansa's body's worth to these people, and juxtaposing them next to each other really, really forces us to look at that and recognize that we could talk about Sansa and her power, but we also have to remember that some of that agency comes from her social class.
Right. Right. And I think Cersei makes this big point of saying, like, I don't want these two together. Like, she's upset that they've been roomed together.
Yes.
Because
her mask slides in that moment.
That's right. And the way I'm reading that is that I think that Cersei feels like she doesn't want any information getting to Sansa that would sort of taint an otherwise, you know, pristine manipulation on Cersei's part, right?
Yeah.
If she can control the information getting to Sansa, then she can create Sansa's reality for her.
Yes, and abusers are most effective when they isolate their victims.
Sure, yeah.
So by giving her a companion, someone who can give her knowledge, which we know Cersei views as powerful, but also companionship. She wants to be Sansa's only lifeline for kindness.
Interesting. The other thing about Jane, of course, we know that Jane is going to be used as political capital under the mask of Arya Stark, right? And she's going to be married to a horrible, monstrous man.
Yeah.
For some reason, I think Baelish thinks that he's going to advance his own agenda by creating some kind of alliance up north, right?
Yeah.
So Jane's body is used very much like someone in Sansa's sort of social rank, right? But she has to put on a mask in order to do it. So it's kind of forced upon her. Whereas Sansa's sort of learning to put on the mask of her own volition, right? Jane doesn't really have any agency. And so she's forced in this horrible situation. But of course, we don't know that. We absolutely don't know that this is what's going to happen until much, much later in the story.
It reminds me to make these historical connections again. So in Elizabeth of York's story, there's a little bit of, mistaken identity, right? Imposters going on. Her brother's die, as far as we know, our young brothers, and that's why the claim becomes hers. And then later on, when she's queen consort to Henry Tudor, Henry the VII, pretenders start to appear. I'm the brother, I'm her brother, you know, I'm the prince in the tower, I got away. And it reminds me of this moment where Jane is passed as Arya. This is a world where people wouldn't know what people looked like.
Jane kind of presents as sort of a highborn, northern-looking kind of girl. Why not? Why not pass her off as Arya?
And so there's this kind of historical point to that too, of the uncertainty of people, and you hear about these people, these noble class, but no one really knows what they look like, and could you pass someone? And that has also created a lot of questioning. Okay, we're putting all of our stake in this marriage, is this even the real person? And we kind of see that playing out on Jane here. And I think it's juxtaposed in the show when with Sansa, you know, she's able to pass as someone else just by dyeing her hair. But it's her hair that's iconic. So when she comes out as a redhead, she's able to kind of stake her claim as Sansa Stark.
Sure.
So there's just some other interesting things going on floating around that as well, that should make us think about how these women are used for their titles. They are forced into these positions. Their bodies become really representative of who they are,
right,
or who they're not.
So I guess the next thing, I think it's a kind of important point to make because it's brought up very specifically in this chapter, and that is that this chapter has a lot of bearing for Ned's story.
Yeah.
And so I feel like we really need, we really need to call out the fact that what Cersei says to Sansa, she says, I know that you must love Joffrey. Otherwise, why would you have alerted me, snuck out of your room and come to me and alerted me that your father was planning to take you back north? And this is a little, so we see a little window into what happened before this fateful throne room scene with Ned, where he gets arrested. Well, what happened was Ned was betrayed, unwittingly or not, he was betrayed by Sansa. Sansa went to Cersei.
It's the reveal. Yeah, it's like an off-page reveal of what happened.
Yes, absolutely. And I was thinking over and over, you know, we always accuse Ned, like, well, what was his downfall? He was just a stupid man of honor. And I was thinking, is it that, or is it that he has this weak spot for children? He always has a weak spot for children. He does not want, you know, Dany to be executed. He doesn't want the Targaryen children to be executed. He doesn't want to drag Joffrey out of his bed at night. And he's absolutely going to try to comfort his daughters and try to explain to them why they need to go back to Winterfell. So in trusting his daughters with a little bit more information that maybe that they need to know, he gives Sansa a chance to exercise her own agency. It's because he loves his daughters. Of course he's going to try to tell Sansa that she's going to get to marry someone else up north, because he thinks that that's what's going to comfort her. It's absolutely the wrong thing to say to Sansa.
Yeah.
But that is, I think this chapter does reveal again that Ned's true weakness is just that he wants to try to comfort children wherever he can. He doesn't view them as political creatures in the same way that Renly or Cersei or Littlefinger does, right?
Yeah, and I think that I love that analysis. I think we can add an extra layer on top of it here, and say that he loves his daughter Sansa and he wants to comfort her, right? Mm-hmm. And trust her, but he doesn't really understand her. He doesn't really know. No. If he understood Sansa, if he had been listening to anything she'd been saying this whole time, he would have known that it's not about getting married. She wants to be in King's Landing. She didn't want to be in the North anymore.
That's right.
She wanted this life. And I think that it also betrays that he doesn't really always see his children clearly. See what they're going
through.
That's
totally true. That does remind me of something that Sansa sees. That's really important. She sees that her beloved Joffrey is nothing like his father, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of when Ned realizes, of course he's nothing like Robert, you know? That's his realization. It was through Sansa's eyes that he kind of came to that realization.
You know, in that moment when we get that reveal, right? You read Cersei's quote, but we also have Sansa's point of view on that, where she says, you know, she's a good girl, obedient girl. She felt as wicked as Arya, so we see her making that force comparison again.
Right.
She's sneaking away, defying her Lord Father. Uh-huh. And then she says she had never done anything so willful before, and she would never have done it then if she hadn't loved Joffrey as much as she did.
Right.
And there's a lot in that too, because she's making this choice here, as you said, she's exercises this agency, she's given this opportunity to. This is the first thing she does that's willful.
Yeah.
And we learn so much about what she wants and what she's motivated by, that she's never done anything so willful, right? She's as wicked of Arya.
Yeah. She thinks that the only way for her life not to be completely ruined is if the king would compel her father to keep her in King's Landing.
Yeah,
that's absolutely, that's her exercising her agency, you know.
Yeah,
she's going above her father's head.
And I think we get, you know, she gets really caught up on this point. So as readers, we get caught up on the point of her love for Joffrey. But I think that we can read past that and see, because she's, you know, a middle school age girl calling it love, but we know it's not love, right? We know that.
No.
I read it as her vision for her own life. and well, what Joffrey yes. means to her. You know, the marriage to him is to leave her home, live in King's mm-hmm. Landing, be like the queen, be powerful. Her dream is about her being queen and having people bow to her, right? And again, I always say this, we may not agree with her. We may not like what she wants, but she's a girl saying, this is what I want, and I'm going to go for it.
Yeah.
And when we see that in other characters, we respect it so much more than we seem to with Sansa.
Well, that's true. And I think, I mean, you said it, and I'm glad you said it. I think that she's in love with King's Landing.
She wants to go to the city.
I think she's fallen in love. She's fallen in love with the colors and the tournament and all of the clothing. She gets to see what the queen wears every day. Like, she's just fallen in love with the southern world, or King's Landing in particular. And of course, Joffrey is her way into that world.
Yeah.
So, yes, of course, she probably thinks that she loves Joffrey. And yet we know, like, well, you might love Joffrey. You might be in love with what Joffrey will allow you to do with your life. And that means staying in King's Landing.
Especially for a girl in her position, who knows that marriage is inevitable and a powerful marriage for her is inevitable.
Absolutely.
You know, we mostly read stories about women and girls who don't want that, and that's the plot, right?
Sure.
But it's not out of the realm of possibility that many would want that, that's okay to want too. And this is something she wants, and we're uncomfortable with how she acts about that, how she acts on that want, and what ends up happening out of, you know, far past what she could see and predict happening. But that's really what's going on here, is that she is she's making choices for her own life as best as she can see with her capabilities at this point in the story.
Right. Oh, yeah. Just to call out a couple notable introductions. For the first time, we are introduced to Sir Mandon Moore, and more importantly, Sansa's letter. Notable departures. I suppose you could say that Jane Poole departs, although it is off page. And presumably her father has departed as well. And then show differences. Of course, anything that includes Jane Poole is going to be a show difference.
Yeah.
I will say this. There is one a little... I was just rewatching the scene in the show. And I did want to point out one thing about the difference in what line Varys is given. In the show, I guess the writers have Varys saying, your father is a traitor. And I think that Varys knows that Ned is not a traitor, so Varys in this way lies. But I think that in the book, and I'll read this little passage, I think that Martin is more careful as to what words he puts on Varys' lips. Here's what Varys says in the book. He says, poor child, murmured Varys, a love so true and innocent. Your grace, it would be cruel to deny it. And yet, what can we do? Her father stands condemned. His soft hands washed each other in a gesture of helpless distress. So here's Varys saying something that's absolutely true. Her father is accused. You know, he does stand condemned. It is cruel what they're doing to her. But Varys, it seems to me, especially in this book, is usually careful to say things that are true in a way that will deceive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about that scene where, you know, he's at trial and he's supposed to, like, you know, give testimony against Tyrion. And everything he says under oath is true, but he leaves out certain details that make Tyrion seem guilty. But on the face of it, it's hard to deny the truthfulness of what he actually says.
Yeah.
Anyway, I noted that difference, and it made me appreciate the way that George writes Varys just a little bit more.
Much more carefully, as you said.
Very careful to omit certain key details, but also not be caught in the lie. It's kind of a brilliant little trick.
10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
And now Steve and I cover the second episode of season 6, simply titled Home. In this episode, Bran sees a vision of young Ned. We say goodbye to Balon Greyjoy, who is assassinated. Arya goes head-to-head with the Waif, but the big news of this episode is that zombie Jon Snow awakes. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Well, Steve, it looks like Heather was right.
She was not in denial. She was, she called it. I'm bringing that actor back to lay on a slab for 2 episodes.
and he got his haircut.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly the resurrection part of it is the big deal, right? That's the lead. You don't want to bury that, right? Mm. But it's not like Jon Snow's hair has been insignificant. He's had a beautiful head of hair.
He's had a luscious mane out there.
I mean, it's been so luscious that he would never even wear a hat when he was about to freeze to death.
It bothered you all that time?
It bothered me the whole time. In fact, I was super bothered about Theon and Sansa not having hats on. I mean, I know that they had to leave in a hurry.
Grab a hat on the way out.
Grab a hat. Grab a hood. Grab something.
Fashion a hat out of something.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, he gets his hair cut. I think that's a good way to get your hair cut.
Yeah.
Because I don't really appreciate haircuts. I don't want to be there for a haircut.
So you cut your hair when you're dead.
Cut my hair when I'm dead and then resurrect me.
That's like the idea of Davos, you know, just like take a little off the top. Not too much, no. Keeps it healthy. A little stronger.
All right, so when did Heather finally convince you? Because certainly you probably got wise before he actually came back to life.
So when Davos wants Melisandre, I'm like, well, yeah, they're gonna bring him back.
They're gonna bring him back. Because you already had Heather in your ear saying, yeah, they're gonna bring him back.
Yeah.
And so
it wouldn't have come to me as an option, right? So then as soon as there's that, it's like, okay, which is a fascinating collaboration, right? To have Davos and her working together somewhat, right?
Or at least
relying on her magic.
That's right. The guy that always hated her evil magic, right, is now imploring her for magic.
He's seen it, right? So yeah. He's seen it. He's seen magic happen. He knows. So we know that he may not believe in what it stands for, but he believes that it exists.
So is that why that he wanted to hold himself up in the room with John? Because that's a lot to put. That's a lot of faith to put on something you've never seen happen.
Right now, because we don't have any. I'm trying to think. Does he know about any of these resurrections? I mean, how are you know?
It could be that he's heard rumors, but even so, like he did meet Gendry, for instance, right?
Right.
They never talk about it, but here's the thing. Even if you've heard rumors, I don't know why you corner yourself into that room with John's body unless you're pretty sure that the body's valuable.
For a battle that's not yours.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that's the whole thing about it. Like, going back to what you were kind of musing about the last time was, well, what's your play here? You don't know. You know John a little. But what are you going to do about it? You know, and if you don't, if this isn't the plan, or, you know, then what was it? And if this was the plan, also why? Yeah, I mean, I guess bringing him back, if you have to be pretty confident that you can bring this guy back to life. Otherwise, you're going to die at the wall guarding the corpse.
Yeah. The play that he should have made was, oh, shoot, John's dead. I'm out of here. Like,
you're right. Yeah,
this is going to get really weird real quick, and these are not my people. I'm gone.
Yeah.
But instead, he pushes himself into a corner and pulls out a sword and sort of allies himself with a dead body.
Right.
So to me, it seems like the only reason for him to do it is so the storyteller can concoct a scenario whereby he can implore Mel to bring him back to life.
Which we aren't 100% sure he knows is an option.
Right, exactly.
So that's the thing, right? Like if it is, if there's been chatter about it, then he just knows about it anecdotally, or he's heard about it. And so if there had been even just a moment where they had had, like him and her had had a conversation, like in the episode prior, it just would have hinted to it or something, you know? I mean, and I guess the thing is, you want to, if you want this particular sequence at the end here to be impactful, you can't hint towards it.
Sure. So, I will say that with all of those problems named, I was still thrilled by the ending.
Sure. Yeah.
I was still all in. I was like, oh, this is, yeah. I'm overlooking all of the plot holes here. This is great.
Right. And what's really interesting too, of all the characters to resurrect that we've lost that have been dramatic, it is interesting that it's John.
Yeah. Tell me more about that. Why is that interesting?
Well, I mean, and I guess you can't, I mean, I guess there's access, right? The way that the narrative has moved it along is that he has Melisandre and the body are in the same area. So that makes it convenient. But I mean, you know, you're writing the story or you're making these stories. There's a lot of other big characters that could have been resurrected and that could have been
a
bigger deal, right?
Sure. You bring Ned back. That'd be a big deal, right?
Right. Or even Joffrey back, you know, I mean, just in terms of like impact. And if resurrection's out there as an option, how come we didn't, you know, it does seem interesting that we haven't seen it really to a main character. And then now we do.
Yeah.
John.
To me, my immediate thought way back in the day when I realized they were going to bring John back was, well, maybe now he's released from his vow, right? Because he was, he was committed to living his entire life at the Night's Watch. And now that maybe he can take up Stannis's offer. But in the book, when I was reading that, Stannis is still alive. Mm. So in the book, Stannis is still alive. So I thought at that point, okay, so now he can say, all right, I fulfilled my vow. I died a loyal member of the Night's Watch. Now I got the second chance. I'm going to go down, find Stannis, and become Jon Stark.
Right.
But the show, I don't think that's going to happen.
Killed Stannis. So obviously it's a great bit of a cliffhanger ending because you're like, well, now what? Right. I mean, what is, because from what, you know, unlike, you know, the story you were telling about from the book where Catelyn is resurrected, but she becomes sort of this vengeful, you know, single-minded kind of person. So her personality changes a bit. Mm-hmm. So there's a part of me that's like, well, will we see that with John? You know, and what might that look like? The questions about like, well, all right, how, you know, they just kill him again if Thorne doesn't, but I guess they have Thorne captured. How does this change everything at the wall? Because all the treason, the people that have committed treason, they're basically, they're locked up from what I understand.
Like, yeah. I mean, well, it didn't, it was kind of helpful that they named themselves.
Yeah. You know, that was helpful.
The first episode, it was a little Scooby-Doo and, you know, who did it? I did. Right, and these other four guys did it.
Yeah.
Bran. We have Bran back.
Bran is back. He's,
he is,
he's,
he's a big boy now.
Yeah, he's been in there for a minute, and I don't know if the three-eyed raven, like Melisandre, who has like a necklace that's enchanted and can be young, but the three-eyed raven has some ability to turn into Max von Sydow. That's pretty cool.
He does. He can turn into Max von Sydow, so that's cool. And I didn't give this credit before, but these Children of the Forest, they're doing good with the haircutting. This is a great haircutting episode. Because if you looked at the three-eyed raven's hair season 4,
that's right.
He had the full-on old man poltergeist thing happening.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And but these children of the forest, they cut his hair, looks really great. They cut Bran's hair, looks really great.
Yeah, and I like how they was like they were both getting their hair cut at the same time, apparently.
And grew a little bit of hair back on top for Max.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, that's good for Max. I mean, Max, you know, I guess that was the look, right? When the children of the forest, like, how do you want me to do your hair? They said, just give me the bot and side out. And man, they nailed it.
So in the book, this guy, he's called the Three-Eyed Crow in the book. And he's like, his body has decayed to the point where the tree is kind of keeping him alive. Mm-hmm. And he's got like roots growing through his eyeballs and one of his eyes is red and he just looks like a corpse, but he's sort of merged with the tree in such a way that he's sort of half man, half tree.
Okay.
This is, you know, I think this is sort of Martin's rated R take on the Ents, half man, half tree creatures.
Got it.
All right, and then we see, of course, Lyanna Stark again in Bran's vision. So again, they're bringing her back into the narrative. And we meet Hodor as a young man.
All right.
Whose name is Willis.
Okay.
And whoever that actor was that played young Hodor, he just knocked it out of the park. Like, he had all of his mannerisms down. It would just...
Oh, yeah.
It was exactly Hodor. You know, props to that guy. He was awesome.
They're begging for a Willis spinoff.
Okay. all right, Steve. This guy who's bragging about exposing himself to Cersei.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I honestly, until this point, and it took 6 seasons for me to get to this point, I thought, oh, you're like a character out of Life of Brian. Like, this guy was giving off a huge Monty Python to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it was. It was little body storytelling. And it was, you know, it was kind of nice to see a little bit of personality in other parts of King's Landing.
See, I'm always complaining that there aren't more commoners in this story. And then I see that guy, and I'm thinking, yeah, maybe not.
We're all right.
This is just going to turn into a Life of Brian. If it's just all this guy.
Yeah, they're all that guy.
We had two people smashed against walls in this episode.
Oh, yeah. That's a good the wall smash count.
Yeah, so the giant, 1-1, he gets shot in the back with an arrow, and he takes the archer and just gives him a nice smash. A little Hulk smash thing happens.
Right.
And then Life of Brian guy... he's super drunk, and the mountain just kind of
mountain stein, whatever.
Now the mountain's preferred way of killing people is to smash their skulls, it seems.
Yeah, he's good at it. I'm telling you, man, I'm kind of a sucker for this Frankenstein mountain thing.
Oh, you like it? You like this guy?
Yeah, quite a bit.
Because so far he hasn't said a whole lot.
Nope, that's what I like. I like that he's just there, man. He's just this new ominous toy. I mean, it's a little out there for me, and I kind of dig it.
So Steve likes the new mountain. That's
I do like the new mountain. Tyrion has a little dragon moment. Like, again, just give me Tyrion looking at dragons is a pretty good montage that I'd watch.
Why didn't he bring in Missandei with him? Like, he asks her, like, Missandei, have you ever been around these dragons? Yes. Have they ever hurt you? No. And then he, like, waxes on about how dragons know friends from enemies, and they don't hurt their friends.
Right.
And then, I mean, to me... Bring Missandei down there. Bring Grey Worm down there with you. Like,
well, I think maybe the thought there is like it doesn't matter, right? If their dragons are going to view him as an enemy, then they'll attack him, and it doesn't matter if he's got one of their friends with him.
All right.
I think I took that as a look. The dragons are going to know regardless, and if I'm going to find out, if I want them to believe I'm a friend, so I'm. maybe by doing that, maybe by going on his own, he's trying to appeal to their...
Or maybe he's the only one that thinks this is a good idea.
Maybe.
Maybe Miss Sandy's like, yeah, I'm out.
Yeah, and good it luck. Could be too. It's like this is what I believe. That doesn't necessarily mean that it always holds true. Like, why bring you down? And like if they don't like me, they may not like that you are with me. So,
all right. So, unlike everyone else in the world, Steve, you were aware of the meme, "I drink and know things," before you actually heard the line in the show.
Right.
So, did you? Was it sort of like, oh? All right, that's where it comes from. Or did it kind of take you out of it?
No, it was one of those where it was like, ah, there it is. Yeah, you know, sure. And
it was like, where's Waldo?
Right. And then it was fun because, like, I don't think Heather is aware of the meme. So she got a real big kick out of it. So it was nice to see it work like that, you know.
Yeah, so
he's got a little both.
Tyrion's sort of all in on this idea that dragons are really intelligent. And some people say that they're even more intelligent than men. And I think that for him, that means they understand language.
Mm.
Because he goes in there and like talks to them like he's gonna sort of win them over with his little speech.
Right.
So I think that that's what he's trying to do.
I think that may be part of it, or even the idea that I'm going to communicate this out loud, because this is what I'm thinking, and that is going, and my body language, right, my energy or whatever is going to be reflective of the speech. So even if they don't understand the language, sure, they'll understand my intent because I'm walking myself.
So, yeah. So he's talking himself into a friendly disposition so that mm-hmm. he can convey that to the beast.
Yeah. That's kind of what I got.
All right. Okay. I will say this. I love that. I thought it was a great scene. These collars that the dragons are wearing.
Easy to come off. Huh?
Yeah. There's like a one little pin. It's a big pin, but it's a pin that holds the collar on that doesn't have a back on the other side of the pin. How is it possible that they haven't fallen off yet?
Or that they haven't figured out how, if they're all smart.
Yeah, if they're that smart, like what the heck?
Like, hey, I don't want this on anymore. Maybe we should just take it off. Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Like that pin needs a little wing nut on the other side. It looks like Ramsay has designs on taking Castle Black.
Right.
He wants to rush the wall and
does he think this is to get Sansa still, or is he other?
His point is to say that as long as Jon Snow is alive, who at that point he thinks that Jon Snow is alive, that the North will never really accept the Boltons as the Wardens of the North.
Okay.
And so even though Jon Snow's a bastard, it'd be better to rush Castle Black and kill him. And then, of course, Roose Bolton says, you act like a mad dog, then you'll be taken out back and slaughtered like a mad dog. And then that's the end of Roose Bolton.
Yeah, that was a big... See, again, these episodes, these first two episodes do not feel... like your first two episodes, right? I mean, I guess the closest thing you could probably do is the episode two where Joffrey dies.
Yeah, that seemed like a bigger to do than Roose Bolton's death.
Sure, but just the it's not just the death of Roose Bolton; it's the it's the sort of the elevation of the self elevation of Ramsay,
right? Because Lady Walda. And we should probably talk about the dismemberment count because probably
lots
Lady Walda and child get torn apart before they get.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you've got, so that's just it now is you've got Ramsay who's like, hey, look, you've given me the name and you've made me the kind of the heir. Now you've been threatening me with this baby for a while, but you know what? They're all gone. The threats are gone. The things you're threatening me with are gone. I've got the last name. I'm a Bolton. I'm running the show. And so that's an interesting moment, right? Because there was, if there was ever any feeling that maybe Ramsay was held in check, it was through his father. And now he's completely unleashed, right? I mean, that's so there's no, so now, but there's also the element that from my perspective is that he's such a sower of chaos that while I see him as a threat, it's a very, I see it as not a long-term type threat. I just don't see him being able to surround himself with strategists and to have the right mentality to do anything too major is what I sense out of it.
Well, you know what I was thinking, Steve? I was thinking, if ever Roose Bolton was a vampire, now's the time to prove it.
That's what we would know, right? I mean, if you just sprayed him with a squirt gun of holy water and that's how he killed him.
There were a lot of fans that were disappointed here. They were thinking, I was just positive Roose Bolton was a vampire. And just as a little bone to throw, he may still be a vampire in the books. We're not certain that he's not a vampire. Yeah, so Roose is dead. Ramsay is now Lord of Winterfell. I think part of the feelings of the ledgers of justice, as far as the storytelling goes, I think it's really important that Winterfell doesn't end up as sort of a Bolton stronghold. I think that at least the sense of it is, in the same way that, like, you know, Heather is feeling that Jon Snow is probably coming back. I think a lot of people are thinking, like, yeah, Winterfell's too important to just forever and always be a Bolton castle.
Of all of them,
that's the right. Boltons. That's right.
So yeah, that's true. And there is but there's also this other sense that I have, like, well, I mean, they like to kill people off that you get somewhat attached to or whatever. And like, then they did it with John. I'm like, am I gonna have to watch John die twice? You know,
Beric Dondarrion, what was it, 6 or 7 times?
Right. There. Well, that's the thing. Is like, is it? I don't know. I don't know how often you're gonna be able to. Yeah,
it's a pretty neat. It's a pretty neat trick. In the same way that Danny can kind of survive fire, I suppose.
Yeah. Right. Well, so that's when you're like, okay, John feels like he matters. And so the other part of it is like, does this do something to the tension of like any time now that John is in trouble? I'm going to be like, well, you didn't bring him back to life to die now, did you? You know, but I don't know.
Well, it's one of those things. John can get stabbed now. Danny can get burned. And Theon can get kicked in the groin. They've all acquired these superpowers. Yeah.
Good for Theon.
Theon leaves.
He bounces,
but it seems as if he's earned some kind of forgiveness from Sansa. And I wonder if that's important for his character, because I think that he was just convinced. I think a large part of what made him reek in the first place was just feeling like he's irredeemable.
Right.
And if Sansa can see it in her heart to forgive him, then maybe there's hope for Theon. Anyway, that's how I read it.
Yeah, that would make sense. And so he says he's going home, right?
So he's going home. And then, of course, War of Five Kings, just do a final wrap up here.
Yeah, that Balon Greyjoy was just like... Like, oh, I wonder what's going to... Oh, he's just... Okay, just right over there.
I'd like to find out about the actor learned, like, oh, they're bringing me back. Bringing me back to season 6 for one episode.
Exactly.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, File a claim right on the State Farm mobile app and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I will share a tiny bit of gossip. No spoilers, I promise. I was recently interviewing David Peterson. You'll remember David is the grammarian who invented Dothraki and High Valyrian. He's also one of the very few people in the world who has had eyes on the new House of the Dragon scripts. Why? Well, because, of course, he's the expert of High Valyrian as the inventor of High Valyrian. And because it's about Targaryens, there's a lot of translation to be done. So David's going to come on the next time I cover Tyrion to help me do a deep dive into his relationship with Tywin. But he told me something about House of the Dragon that I thought I would share with you. Of course, this is just one man's opinion, so go ahead and take it with a grain of salt. But David says that the scripts that he's read are some of the very best dialogue he's ever seen on a page. That interview will be in a month or so. I share it with you now only to give you a tiny ray of hope as we anticipate the new Game of Thrones prequel series. And that is all for this week.